So thank you very much. My credentials are, I have received my PhD from the University of St. Gallen, Switzerland, on the topic of the international health regulations and the executive authority of the World Health Organization during public health emergencies of international concern. Very long title. And it's not my phone. And I was a visiting researcher at Georgetown Law under Professor Gorsten, funded by the Swiss National Fund. Later, I collaborated with the International Health Regulation Secretariat in Geneva at the World Health Organization and conducted WHO country missions for the purpose of national implementation of the International Health Regulation. So, good. The other experts that were providing their expertise, the last we heard from Mr. Bush was were speaking about financial, geopolitical, and security issues, particularly under the paradigm of bioterrorism, that provide evidence there, that there is a path that led to the current COVID-19 pandemic. I would like to focus the attention to the fact that we are currently not confronted with a medical pandemic response. Most of the criticism raised by the scientists and doctors center around the issue that, from a pure medical perspective, all health measures recommended and required by national health authorities or WHO are actually contrary to the epidemiological and medical state of the art. And this is so on purpose, I contend, because the underlying concept used for COVID-19 does not follow established scientific principles, but rather a different ideology, which is called or framed as global health security, and means to treat health as a national security issue requiring national and global states of exceptions to deal with it. Therefore, I consider it crucial to provide a short historic analysis of this concept in order to understand why the current global health crisis we face is not about medical science and health in the common sense we would expect. So the progressive replacement of medical with political aims started in the context of emerging infectious diseases in the early 1990s and originated actually from the US, as we already heard. Within a short period of time, WHO institutionalized this new approach by the rapid setup of an entirely new division called Emerging and Other Communicable Diseases. And interestingly, they didn't engage the staff of the Communicable Disease Control Department at that time. This policy confirmed that the new paradigm shift from lowering the incidence of regionally endemic diseases was to the sole focus on preventing the international spread in real time and most preferably within a 24 hours time frame. There was a need for a technocratic apparatus of surveillance networks that were capable to deal with these new threats. So consequently, in 2001, there was a resolution of the World Health Assembly that already inserted this novel concept and called for the first time to find a definition for a public health emergency of international concern for the purpose of revising the outdated sanitary laws called international health regulations, because nobody was interested in sanitary laws at that time. The problem was they had a very narrow scope and applicability only for yellow fever, black, and cholera. So at the same time, particularly in the US, bioterrorist scenario planning, we all heard right now a lot about it, within the military and at the academic level, with the most prominent exercise like Dark Winter, was launched. And interestingly, all those events went real short after that. But what is also very interesting and we did not hear is that not only the exercises were held, which turned into reality, also the legislation in the US was prepared to curtail civil liberties for the fight against bioterrorism from 1990 onwards. This undertaking was started by the CDC and eventually finalized by professors from Georgetown University, like Professor Gorsten, together with the Johns Hopkins University, and it was called the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act. This model act has been sharply criticized at that time in the US for transforming governors into dictators, but was used over many states eventually. So the most important milestone in the revision process of the international health regulations, which is an international treaty, was the outbreak of the severe acute respiratory syndrome, abbreviated as SARS, as we all know, in 2002, which was accompanied by an alerted media attention that was not proportionate to the threat of the disease, which was remarkably low. In addition, there was a quasi-consensus among scientists that the novel SARS outbreak could have had a bioterrorist potential. This political bioterrorist framing of the SARS outbreak led to the agreement of the international community that the old sanitary laws needed to be rewritten to include bioterrorism without naming this goal officially at WHO. This came under the paradigm of an open, all-hazards approach, which means that not only various sources of risks were included, but also that any intentional release would come under the paradigm of the WHO and that the IHR needed to be revised. So the legal dimension of the global health security concept was eventually successfully integrated into international health regulations in 2005, and thus the US model of public health emergencies has been exported to the international community and is now merged into national constitutions, which were never having such constitutional emergency provisions. Then the outdated IHR provisions of disease containment were replaced to include pathogens that pose a threat to national security and require an emergency regime that enabled the derogation of legal standards, not only in terms of medical safety regulations, but also in terms of fundamental standards, freedoms and civil rights. According to this new paradigm, endemic diseases which count for the most death do not fall under the attention of this global set of rules, which are now the standard procedure for pandemics, but only newly identified pathogens without medical treatment that therefore require an emergency licensing, as these substances are all unlicensed. In addition, the importance of diagnostics emerged under the global health security ideology as a new priority issue, because the threat needs to be identified as threatening prior to devastating effects according to this ideology. So this the availability of diagnostics is labeled as necessary requirement for pandemic preparedness and response. So I hope you can follow. Moreover, under the threat of bioterrorism, the establishment of laboratories boosted throughout the world, as Mr. Bush already explained to us. Because biological weapons are defined as weapons of mass destruction and constitute a crime under international law, the only legal pathway to lawfully undertake research and medical treatment is called biodefense, which takes place in laboratories, as we learned. I would like to remember that all SARS coronaviruses come under the US category C of potential bioterrorism agents, and also classified under the expert regime of the EU for dual use, which refers to the potential of civil and military use. So I hope now that the picture becomes a bit clearer why some historic knowledge is needed to understand why WHO and the global community do not address SARS-CoV-2 in accordance with the state of the art of medical knowledge, but rather fight the virus as a threat to the nation in an unproportionately manner, with military instead of medical terminology referred to it as medical and non-medical countermeasures. And throughout all health ministries in the world, new departments are established called National Health Security Departments. So this was part one of my kind of expertise. If you have questions, because then I would like to explain how all those newly identified diseases came to WHO. Or should I just go forward? Okay. If you have no questions. As a second step, I would like to explain in more detail why the small number of atypical pneumonia cases of Wuhan in late 2019 and in the first days of 2020 were reported to WHO and soon ended up as a public health emergency of international concern, and soon later as a pandemic. This is all due to the international health regulations and the revision thereof. Although the IHR, referred to as IHR, include an all-hazards approach, some pathogens, like any novel strain of an influenza subtype or any SARS coronavirus, are still prioritized and have to be reported within a 24-hour time limit to WHO. The identification of this novel virus was possible because China has a very tight screening regime for respiratory diseases since the SARS outbreak in 2002. Thus, it was possible for China to identify this novel pathogen. Already on the 1st of January, WHO requested more information about the outbreak due to information by Taiwan. On the 3rd of January, China notified WHO officially of a cluster of 44 patients, of which 11 were severely ill with pneumonia of unknown etiology after WHO.
That doesn't sound
44
like,
cases.
It does not sound like a pandemic.
Yeah, that's true. After the WHO already requested more information. And there was the closure of the Wuhan market. So this politicization and interest of WHO at this very early stage, at the 1st of January, when only 44 people had this atypical pneumonia and 11 people suffered severely from this atypical pneumonia, is indeed an interesting aspect that should lead to some precautions about how the entire crisis started. As there were no deaths reported and no international cases, and the potential of human-to-human transmission was not assessed at that time. In the meantime, the novel virus was identified as the SARS coronavirus. So this means the identification of this new virus falls under the international health regulations that formally requires an automated official report to WHO, and the Director General is obliged to constitute an emergency committee under the IHR once such an official notification has been received. So he's legally obliged to constitute this emergency committee. Then, now it's becoming interesting, at the same time, Professor Drosten and others worked in Germany intensely to deliver to WHO a diagnostic test assay via the PCR method for this novel virus. And Professor Drosten was also the lead author in 2003 when the novel SARS coronavirus was identified, and since then nominated as WHO expert. His first protocol was officially delivered to WHO on the 13th of January 2020, which implied that he had, of course, worked prior to this date of submission, and WHO immediately circulated this first protocol of this assay to its member states. Later, this assay was a bit revised and finally published in the Eurosurveillance Journal on the 23rd of January. So he also contributed to the WHO interim guidance, dated on the 10th of January. And this interim guidance was published. You can have more information if you want to later, but it's getting complicated otherwise. This information guidance was published as a part of a comprehensive package of about 10 guidance documents of WHO for countries covering topics related to the management of an outbreak of the new coronavirus disease. So on the 10th of January, WHO had a comprehensive package already published at that time. That's, interesting.
At a time when there were literally no cases, except for the 44 cases
And these were getting officially. And it normally takes a very long time at WHO to get something published because it has to be cleared. Mm-hmm. Importantly, as any SARS coronavirus requires an official notification under the IHR, the Director General had to convene a COVID-19 emergency committee as a legal obligation under the IHR. You can find on the WHO website the experts who are on this committee, and you can find your CVs there. This emergency committee advises the Director General in the proclamation whether a public health emergency of international concern exists, which is an executive authority of the Director General in accordance with the legal principles set out under the IHR. So the first meeting was held on the 22nd of January, where the experts found no agreement whether a fake, that's the abbreviation of public health emergency of international concern, what WHO uses, so a fake exists or not. And they agreed that there was no international spread of the novel coronavirus outbreak, which was due to 17 deaths and 557 confirmed cases on the 22nd of January. So they had an idea. They said within 10 days, they will again meet and consult and assess the current situation of new cases. That's what they did on the 13th of January. And by then, the cases have risen from over 500 cases to 14 times higher to 7,711 confirmed and even much more, 12,167 suspected cases. That's all in the statement of the second emergency committee of the WHO. All in, official information you can look up yourself.
How are the cases defined? Test results?
The cases defined, the confirmed, will have been confirmed by this essay of Professor Trustin because it was an official publication circulated by the 13th of January, and it was also worked into the later published interim guidance, laboratory testing of human suspected cases of novel coronavirus. So these documents are still all online at WHO because sometimes it could be that they are withdrawn afterwards, but they are still online and can still be looked up. And it's still all referenced to Drosten and his publication.
When was the first emergency meeting and when was the second one again?
The first was at the 22nd of June, and then they agreed January. They did not have enough cases because it were only 555 cases or 57 cases, and there was no international spread. And the international spread is a precondition for calling and for defining a public health emergency. So they had to wait 10 days, and then there was a 14 times increase of cases, of course, through the rapid diagnostics, which was also referenced in the statement that they were very grateful that there were rapid diagnostics. So they could identify and diagnose this new threat called SARS-CoV-2.
So what had happened is Drosten had delivered his test kit to the World Health Organization, and through the use of his new test, all of a sudden we had 14 times the number of cases that existed before he used his test.
That's what the documents say.
Okay, I would like to make a remark on this, because we have like also information from a Freedom of Information Act request that we did with Charité. And, it turns out that actually the company Tipmol Biol, which produced the test together developed it together with Drosten. They were listed. The constellation came that basically they were doing the logistics, the Charité claimed, and sending when someone got in touch with Drosten. And the companies, the countries knew that Drosten was the one in charge or had this developed this test, like from the information kit that you said that was sent out through the WHO.
The test essay from WHO to the member states, because it was then an official guidance that he delivered.
But there was the contact information was to Drosten and to Tipmol Biol, so they knew they could get in touch with them, and then Tipmol Biol would do the send out, like for Drosten or for someone else. So it was basically all at their hands, and they could deliver it worldwide. It did. I think it did not go through via the WHO itself, but like through this connection of the first mover advantage, basically, of what the two had developed.
But what this boils down to is that the cases that they needed in order to declare a public health emergency of international concern came into existence because of the test. Is that correct?
At least they needed the international transmission, and they have to diagnose it. And without diagnostic test assays, it's not possible. So the only one who gave this test assay is in the document referenced as Drosten. Mm-hmm. That's what the documents say. So
had it not been for his test, the WHO 10 days later would still have probably had 44 cases or maybe 500 cases, but not 14 times that many.
If there is no test, you cannot qualify it as the new virus. That's the problem. And that's also and the really important thing everybody should know is that the proclamation of a public health emergency of international concern, because this is connected to vaccine manufacturing. That's the most important thing any legal person or anybody should know. It's not the pandemic. There is no legal consequence if WHO proclaims or defines a pandemic. That's just interesting for the media. But the public health emergency is connected to the regulatory pathway for emergency use authorization.
Without a public health emergency of international concern, there cannot be any use of untested drugs like vaccines.
Right, because all secondary laws like the EU, the FDA, the US, they use the concept of the public health emergency also proclaimed by WHO.
Okay, Virginie wants to ask a question.
Yes, Mrs. Behrens, Virginie de Arrougeau, Atlantic, France. I would like to confirm with you that Mr. Bill Gates put pressure on the WHO to declare a pandemic, and that we know that Charité Berlin, which is linked with Drosten, has developed these tests with the financing of Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and Wellcome Trust. I don't know if you can confirm that.
Maybe Astrid, I don't know so much about financing, I know more about regulatory issues. Astrid?
It's a good question. What we can confirm, and that's what I was going to explain to you, is that there is really a plan since 2000, even maybe before 1999, there is a plan that you can see chronologically with events that is mounting up Gavi from a vaccine alliance in UNICEF to start joining the United Nations, not only with UNICEF, but with the World Bank and WHO through a financing of this IFFM, the International Financing Facility Immunization. So they did a triad in 2006. They started, and at the same time, Gavi started to be a global alliance in Switzerland as a foundation. So they registered in 2006 at the same time as they did a tripartite agreement between World Bank, WHO, and Gavi to get financing from the member states. You can find this on the web. So that was the first step. And as you know, 2006, the IHR started to be in the implementation phase. And what we can find out is tracking. What he's doing is that he started to, I'll jump to the most important. In 2009, he registered as an international organization in Switzerland of a new type. And we have a press release signed by the Swiss government that shows that it was created specifically for Mr. Bill Gates, this international organization with total immunity. You cannot do anything. You cannot even take him to tribunal. They do their own tribunal if they have any sort of disagreement. And from then on, he started, and we have the documents in the WHO logo. You know, they have executive boards. We can find, I found out very lately that we can find out everything on the web, so we can find this. And they created a decade, 2010-2020, of the global of vaccine decade. And we did the implementation, IHR implementation, because you had to teach and train the countries to be prepared. And we finished the first round in 2012, from 2009 to 2012. We received with Georgetown University, Pretoria University, and I was with University of Geneva. And at that time, when we stopped the round, we got funds again from Japan, and suddenly it stopped. And they said, there is no more fund. And we had almost the contract signed. And I found out now that I know why, because in 2012, at the World Health Assembly, they did, and they put Bill Gates as the leader of the Global Vaccine Action Plan 2012-2020. So it's beautifully carved. From then on, he was in the driver's seat. And it's mentioned, you know, the Gavi is the leader of most of what is concerning vaccine. And it's not only children like UNICEF anymore, it's the whole world. So you can see, I mean, if that's enough of a proof of at least that there is a plan, and it keeps on. I mean, he is in the stage group, the strategic expert advisory group, and they did even a, it's very funny, it's not funny, but they even did in 2016 an assessment report of this 2012-2020 Global Vaccine Action Plan, GAPC. And in 2016, they are very upset because they did not immunize the whole world. So immunization is vaccination, and they would take any excuse with vaccination. And they don't talk about experimental or validated. It's all vaccine, of course. And in 2016, you can really see that they're not happy. And Mr. Gavi Global is saying that we really have to make an effort. So they have made a program called the Accelerator Program of Vaccine. Okay, so that's at least some of the steps that you can get very clearly. It's all on the web. Without talking about the financing, which I can talk about too. Yeah.
What happened? Who received basically diplomatic immunity in 2009? Was it Gavi, or was it Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, or was it Bill Gates personally, or all of them?
No, it's really Gavi Alliance Foundation, but they took away the name Foundation. And in the agreement, it's really Gavi, the Global Alliance for Vaccination. Yeah, I can find the exact term in my paper. Mm-hmm. But, no, it concerns really him. The Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation are rather, what I find out more and more is that they are more the financial mechanism of funding or receiving funds for programs. And I found out again that the Swiss government, Swissmedic, the FDA of Switzerland, has signed an agreement to, it's in 2020 to 2023, to provide to the Bill and Melinda Gates $900,000 in 3 years, so $300,000 every year, for his program, project. And you cannot see in the paper, you have to go and look at the project, and I did not go, but it concerns the vaccine. So I'm suspecting that when we take a model like Switzerland, or like Sylvia said about mechanics between the national and international health regulation, it's been applied like a model everywhere in the world, that the law on epidemics of a national country is binding to international health regulation. We found that in Switzerland, even the constitution of Switzerland has a little line they have added without asking us, which says that international law supersedes national law in the health matters. Mm-hmm. And then you can see that in the law of epidemic that was passed in 2016. So probably in all countries we should check. And I'm pretty sure we saw that in Canada, that there is a law of epidemics, a law of emergency law that says to the country they will obey to the international health regulation. And so if fake is declared public health emergency of international concern, every country has to put and trigger immediately the mechanism of obeying. And that's what explains why when in on 16th, 17th of March or in this area, the whole world locked down. Because this is incomprehensible according to the international health regulation. And according to the SARS-CoV-1, it never happened like this ever, that suddenly the virus was everywhere. And it's what's happening with Omicron too, you know. It starts in South Africa and the next day it's all over the world.
Yeah, but is there any, as far as the international health regulations are concerned, Sylvia and Astrid, Is there any democratic legitimacy to these health international health regulations? Has anyone who invented these international health regulations been voted into some office? Is there any democratic legitimacy to this? Or is this just a private enterprise by people who control the World Health Organization?
I can answer first, and then Sylvia, you can fill in. When we were teaching and training about the international health regulation, it was the question that came very often in: how come this is binding to member states? And it was an extraordinary answer, which will explain to you how important it is to look at this new pandemic treaty now. It's that WHO, I have looked and looked, it is for the moment the only United Nations specialized program or an agency who has a constitution. So WHO constitution, not convention, constitution, article 21, 19, 21A and 2 are binding member states directly if they adopt the international health regulation. So they don't need to go through the whole procedure of a treaty. They can, and that's why it's very dangerous. This WHO constitution is like if it was planned to supersede all constitutions of the world. Because why would you use the word constitution? And so the answers of the lawyers from WHO was always, oh, we have adopted it at the General Assembly of 2005 under the WHO Constitution, Article 21A and Article 2.
Yeah, but the funny thing is, and it's not funny at all, that those people who created the international health regulations have not been voted into their, or have no authority. Or is there any connection between the member states' people, not their governments, the member states' people, and these international health regulations? Or is there only the Constitution, which they themselves invented?
Let me explain the mechanism of the United Nations, and it's almost with all, it's with all the big agencies like the International Labour Office, the ITU, the telecommunication, for the refugee. Every year, you have a World Assembly, with like an NGO, like, you know, a World Health Assembly every year takes place in the United Nations in Geneva in May, it's the third week of May, where all member states have their little seat and they are all together and they have an agenda and they decide about the agenda of the world together. So this explains, and but normally, if there is a big decision, they are just children of the United Nations General Assembly, so they should go up to the General Assembly and it has to get the blessing of the Secretary General, which is the head of the United Nations, which should give a blessing to WHO. I don't see this in the case of international health regulation, if that's a piece, a clue.
Well, I just add to this that the international health regulations, because we started with 1815 something some hours ago, and these it's a very interesting regime because it's an international treaty that dates back to the sanitary conventions from 1850. So it's one of the oldest international legal regimes which were taken over to WHO and which were recognized under the WHO constitution because they already had in mind, and that's very true, they had in mind that they wanted to have a regulatory fast-track regime. So they had this regulatory process that says under the regulations for sanitary laws, which is now pandemic laws, you could refer to, you have the member states need to opt out and not opt in. So by the resolution that is passed, the international treaty has to enter into force in the member state. Otherwise, it has to opt out on purpose. So it's the reverse process of international law. And that's a very unique thing. And I think no other international organization, or I found no other international organization having this capacity. So, but what they did It's democratic because it was an intergovernmental negotiation process. And the interesting thing is that only because of the emergence of SARS, they had this new ideology adapted of the global health security idea that not the endemic diseases are devastating to the people, but only new diseases that have no medical treatment. So they inserted this new concept in the old laws that were ever existent at WHO and ever existent in the world. So they adopted this totally new ideology, and that's the very, very striking thing we have now. And it's passed as a resolution. And the interesting thing is it's an international treaty, and WHO is not a party. It's only bound by the resolution, whereas other international treaties like the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control, the WHO is a signatory. So that's in international law a bit tricky.
I still don't understand. I don't see any connection between myself, my countrymen, and these international health regulations.
That's a problem of international law.
Not really. I think this is quite unique.
Because member states have adopted. Member states gave their consent in 2005. They all said they wanted to have this new kind of rules for international law, and now they are obliged to implement it nationally. Or since 2007, it entered into force, and they are obliged to implement it. And for example, Austria. I'm from living in Austria. We have no emergency clause in our constitution, and we did not adopt our sanitary laws, our epidemiology laws. There is no clause of emergency, and we still have the same regime. So that's what I always say. Whatever legal regime and whatever constitution countries have, obviously the system can impact any country and any constitutional system and any legal regime. It's possible with or without emergency clauses. They apply emergency rules. That's what I can see, at least that's my opinion.
Yeah. It's the same with the Millennium Development Goal and the Sustainable Development Goals, which seem to match, 2000 to 2015, 2015 to 2030, the Sustainable Development Goal, they're doing a whole mechanism around this, and it becomes more and more obscure, and it is more and more obscure how much us as citizens really decide, and we don't decide anything anymore because it becomes so complex and obscure.
We definitely have to take our sovereignty back. That is the conclusion that I draw from this. Because even if the EU wants to come up with a new law, for example, they can decide that they want to introduce these laws. But unless the member states ratify it in their own countries, it doesn't become law in their countries. So this is quite surprising to me, and I think to many lawyers who should know about these things as well. This is very disturbing, I think.
Yeah, and the EU has created this HERA agency, which is the same, but probably much more coercive. That's a huge, huge problem. And they have no authority in health matters, but they still pretend to have it and still create the agencies and instruct on us without democratic processes.
And yeah,
HERA stands for Health Emergency Response Agency, right?
Yeah.
And isn't there a rumor that if our national member state governments in the EU collapse, then they're going to take over, and under the EU Commission, there will be a kind of a mini world government? Does it sound plausible?
I have no idea, but I'm sure they would love to.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's the idea of this pandemic treaty, because this pandemic treaty has articles at the end who say that with the constitution of WHO, we don't need any other constitution as member states. And not only do they diminish the power of member states, which is what is a United Nation, but they have invited a whole lot of non-state actors, they call it, NGOs, Gavi, intergovernmental. He's an NGO, international organization, because he can use many, you know, things. Bill and Melinda Gates might be an NGO, and then they make different things. The Rockefeller Foundation, I've met them in WHO. They come and sit in meetings, and, you know, they are NGO. We don't know what they are. So the non-state actors are also invited in this new treaty, which would take over literally through WHO constitution, a world constitution because of pandemic.
So ultimately what we're looking at is private associations, private individuals even, taking over our national governments through the World Health Organization, using health as a crowbar to do whatever they want.
Yeah, we could say that because the public-private partnership has been, you can see it through the financing, because Gavi and private partners have started to invade and interfere the whole United Nations. I actually looked into this because I was called to organize for the, you know, Switzerland joining the United Nations, the whole United Nations open days for 2 days, etc. So I learned a lot of organization that nobody hears about, and one is really a private entity called the UN Global Compact. Mm. And this United Nations Global Compact is only private sector. And they can, for example, finance. It's it's open to partnerships.
Yeah. And just to add on this, also the implementation of the international health regulations, it's very strange because it's done by joint external evaluations undertaken by the Global Health Security Agenda. And if you look up the page of the website of the Global Health Security Agenda, it says it has a private consortium, and you don't know, you have no information which private consortium this is, but you know that these external evaluators go to Germany, go to every country. It's even on the website of the RKI applauding how great it is, but they don't say it's implemented by private entities. You don't know. So I don't want to have laws implemented by private entities. That's absolutely undemocratic. And they are very proud of it. Very proud of it.
That's bizarre.
If I understand well, there's private advisors that are working also with the WHO, like McKinsey and Accenture. They are the arm of the Bill Gates Foundation also.
Yeah, it's a good question. I've actually looked for the link McKinsey and WHO, because we know that they are creating the communication. And I think they have been putting it under something they're setting up now, an intergovernmental panel. What is the exact title? Intergovernmental panel for this treaty for negotiating network, something like that. So this is just happening. It just happened at the executive board. So it is a bit worrying, because you think that, and I think that all those communication agencies are buried into that. They're not only one.
So what is this treaty adding to the situation that we have right now?
Well, the treaty is very mythical. I just heard the legal counsel, the former legal counsel of WHO speaking about it. It's available on the internet. And it's very political. It's probably the most fierce proponent is Charles Michel. He suggested this treaty. The European Union wants this treaty. The US is kind of opposed to it. They made a proposal that the IHR should be strengthened. So the problem will be a two-track world, because if they are rushing into a treaty, only a small number of signatories will sign, and the IHR is a universally acknowledged tool, and we did not mention that it would actually have good aspects in it, which are neglected and infringed. It has a human rights implementation clause, which is not respected, absolutely violated. So there were compromise deals at the end when they passed through the resolution, but it's just that they are not mentioned, and nobody, there's no court, which would, you know, find a violation of this. So the problem is what they would like to do is to have an upstream and a downstream of pharmaceutical industry, probably, because it's not even clear the scope of the treaty. Not even this is clear. The only thing is that there's a lot of communication about it. The Director General is a very huge proponent of this treaty because he's very political in a way. It's very, very strange what kind of intentions are behind that. And it's called for preparedness and response. So what we know is that they invented a new procedure, which is also problematic. It's called WHO Emergency Use Authorization. That's where a huge company, big pharma, can go to WHO, say, I'm inventing a new pharmaceutical for or new diagnostic set for this kind of disease, for this public health emergency, and we would like that you put it on our list. And then WHO puts it on the list and has a disclaimer, disclaiming that there's no warranty and no endorsement of WHO. And if somebody dies, it's not WHO fault, it's only a list. And then Gavi takes this list and says, oh, we can export it to the entire world, even if we don't have stringent and very competent medical authorities. We have this listing of WHO and now we can contribute it to the world. That's what they do in the treaties of Gavi and this vaccine alliance, this COVAX facility, it's called, the third pillar of this ACT accelerator. And they probably would like to find better regulatory ways that it becomes a normal process that big pharma goes to an international organization, but then actually it's a treaty of private international law, not of public international law. Because the problem of customary international law is not recognized. It's jus cogens, that means it's a norm which you cannot derogate from, that there are no medical treatments whatsoever without your consent. So, it's a huge problem.
So we've learned tonight from all of the other experts, including, of course, the three experts who testified at the beginning of this session, that, for example, in the UK, healthcare has been largely privatized. It's being controlled by private groups, private charities even. We've learned that through this privatized, even their psychiatric system has been privatized. There's private people behind all of this, and this is how they control everything. They even create their own future leaders, next to what the World Economic Forum is doing, meaning they have their own people who they then seem to be telling what to do in positions of of power in the governments. Now, if I look at the WHO, there's a man by the name of Tedros. He's the director general. Who is he? I have read in the papers that in his own country, people are, a criminal complaint has been filed against him for genocide. Is that the typical, let's say, puppet that the private entities who are running the healthcare show are using in order to further their aims?
I have never seen a director general like that. I've known many, but I know also from inside that the staff was very unhappy with him and they asked for his resignation, and of course it never happened. Uh-huh. So, yeah, and another scoop, if I did not say this already, is that on the board of Gavi Foundation, you can see the names of people who have been part of Gavi. Well, Tedros has been part of Gavi before he was elected director general, conflict of interest. Ah. And so he was on the board between, I wrote it here, January 2009 and September 2011. And that's one of them. And the other person, conflict of interest, the president of Ireland, who was at the head of the Human Rights Commission, and I know her, but I'm very surprised that she was there with president, with signature even of Gavi, from November 2008 to the September 2011. I can give you the papers, no problem. You know, it's very precise, 25 November 2008 to 14th of September 2011. So you see that and there are many names that I don't know, and I'm sure you will find there many names that you can maybe find in your countries too, because there are country representatives that are in Gavi before they were even in position. So it's clear that he was already entangled with Bill Gates.
So wherever you look, you see conflicts of interest. Debbie and Anna have their hands up.
Yes, I checked to see which countries are members of the WHO. Are you? I see many, many, many. I don't see any I don't recognize. Are there any countries? 194. Are there any countries that are not members of WHO?
At the moment, I think the U.S. Oh no, they came back. Okay. No, the Vatican is an observer in the United Nations, as you might know or not, and that's also a topic I wanted to talk about when you talk about values, religion, psychop. Yeah. So they're observers, and they're everywhere. The other religions are, in general, at the World Council of Churches. Right in front of the big building that Bill Gates has been building with our Swiss money in 3 years. I mean, it's been, you have to know this. Oh, no, that was a question, so I answered, right.
So there are no countries that are not members. The Vatican might be an observer, but it's not a member. But
No. Uh-huh. I don't know of any. Sylvia, would you say? Even though there was 196, you're muted, Sylvia.
So it's 196 to the international health regulations, because the Vatican and Liechtenstein, they are not WHO members, but they are member to the signatory to the international health regulations.
Debbie has her hand up.
I would just want to add something that might be interesting legally. There are in the annex in the notes at the end of this international health regulation of 2005, two countries who made reservations that they don't agree with that completely, because they want to apply their global security nationally. And you would guess who it is. It's the US and Iran. Aha. So it's interesting to see that two countries have managed to put a reservation to this. Mm-hmm. How come the others haven't? Or mm-hmm. No.
It's because their people haven't spoken, but they will. Debbie.
Oh, thank you. I just wanted to mention very quickly, when you mentioned about the UK, we've also got a serious issue going on here with the unvaccinated, in that anybody that seems to be admitted to hospital with a COVID-19 positive seemed or would appear to be put on an end-of-life, an accelerated end-of-life care plan. And patients seem to be given midazolam and morphine. And this is without their consent. This is without their family's consent. These decisions are made by the clinicians alone, and the families and the patient doesn't have any say in it at all. So I just want to be sure to include the victims of this absolute disaster that are unvaccinated. And also, just to bring your attention to CEPI. CEPI was founded in 2017, and CEPI and Gavi work very closely together, in fact, financially very closely together. And when CEPI was launched in 2017, Bill Gates at the World Economic Forum launch said that basically they would be cutting out the safety with regards to clinical trials. It would just be, and he said it straight out, and it was actually featured on UK Column News, but Bill Gates said that the safety data and manufacturing would be cut out, which would enable the 100-day mission to go ahead to have vaccines rolled out within 100 days of the World Health Organization declaring a pandemic. So I just wanted to mention that. And also with regards to Whitney earlier talking about DARPA, we have our very own kind of diluted DARPA, if you like. We have ARPA, but we also have Welcome Leap, which Whitney has got a lot of information about when it comes to bioweapons and making of biochemicals. And also, I just want to go back to the patent as well, because the Rothschild's patent of 2015, if you look at the full paper, everything that we're seeing today was put into that. And it was approved in 2020, but it was given priority in 2015. So it was written in 2015. And what we're seeing now is everything within that patent. So that, together with SPARS pandemic, and SPARS pandemic 2025 to 2028 was a coronavirus. And some of the names are the same as in the John Hopkins futuristic scenario, like Coronavax. So there's an awful lot of similarities there. And I know that you've been talking about lockstep, but I just want to just re-remind people that SPARS pandemic 2025 to 2028 gives a month by month breakdown. And if you look at when we first started in the March, when we had the first case in our country anyway, or in December in Wuhan, it literally goes month by month. So the prediction going forward would appear to be antimicrobial resistance, which is already what is written in SPARS. And we're finding many people in this country not being able to access antibiotics, and GPs and physicians here not wanting to give antibiotics. So I just wanted to throw that in. Thank you.
So we do have lots of reason to worry about our sovereignty. Not the least of one is the World Health Organization's international health regulations. That seems to be the overarching theme. This is how, through their constitution and through the revision, through the revised international health regulations, they seem to be trying to gain control over the rest of the world, including, of course, all the 196 member states. Is this a correct assessment?
Yeah, at least I think because in the first part of my expertise, I stressed that the military aspects were included in this agenda, but were not named. Mm-hmm. So that's the reason why we have now kind of pandemic response, which is not medical, which is unproportionate and political, and we do not realize it. Because they included this bioterrorist scenario and they adapted the language to global health security, that's also with the Center for Civilian Biodefense, also at the time at Dark Winter, it was called Johns Hopkins Global Health Security Center, was called Center for Civilian Biodefense, I think was the correct name. And they had also a journal called Bioterrorism or Biodefense, and now it's called Global Health Security. So we should not forget about that a bio war could go on, at least. So it's much more political, as the politicians would themselves agree.
Mm-hmm. I will add 2 points. One, we should worry about the whole United Nations, because the Sustainable Development Goals are 17 goals and 169 targets. It's the Agenda 2030, and it is all entangled, especially with the climate change, for example. But there are many other mechanisms under that have to be looked at. The second, such as the UN Alliance for SDG financing. I mean, what is this? I'm finding, you know, when you dig, you find a lot of things very mysterious that we have to find out. But the other one that might interest you is remember that pandemic or epidemic or public health emergency of international concern has four typologies. That's what I was taking care of the case studies, and it was very important to distinguish. And that's what we should do with what's going on now, because we're all focused on the biological factor. But in fact, the first one is infectious biology. The second is foodborne biology. And there's a whole organization behind called InfoSan. The third is chemical. And chemical is mercury, can be metal, etc. And there was one expert, Kirsten Gutschmidt, a German that I was inviting, and he was always making they're great reports, but very difficult to find the experts there. And the fourth, which is very important, and you will see why, is radionuclear radiation. And that's even more difficult to find experts. And I realized this because in our courses, we were inviting people who are taking care of this. It is the International Atomic Energy Agency based in Vienna. And they are experts on radionuclear, Chernobyl, Fukushima. They are the first in line there. And what I was shocked about is when we were doing the case studies of Fukushima, we asked, so what did WHO do? And they said, no, WHO was not allowed to access Fukushima. They were refused the visa because the first one to be there is the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency. And what is very strange is that they have an agreement or anyway, a written statement which gives them power over WHO. So I went to look at what they're doing now with COVID just today. So I'm very happy to tell you, or very scared to tell you, that they are in charge of the RT-PCR kit. It's a crazy. And actually, to know, just before I say how they have presented this, is they are independent from the United Nations. They have their own international treaty, and they report to the UN General Assembly and to the Social Security Council every year. So this is for nuke. It's for radionuclear threats, which could kill the whole planet. So they say that the IAEA has developed a nuclear-derived diagnostic technology that can help detect and identify COVID or anything else in hours, in humans and in animals, because animals is treated by veterinary and by FAO, the Food Administration Organization. And they have developed this test, and this test is very efficient, the RT-PCR, because it's polymerized chain reaction and rapid test. They think they are the experts. And that especially for Ebola, Zika, and the African swine fever virus. So this is just today, I read this, and for me, it rings a bell, because they are offering now the test kit, a PCR test kit, and their lab. So they're linked to labs. And we were talking, that's where the power lies and where things have to be, I think, looked at closer. I don't know what you think, Sylvia, but that's a bit worrying.
You mean other private organizations or half private, or most of these organizations which we spoke about tonight, pretty much all of the international organizations are more or less controlled by private citizens, by private groups, charities, etc. So this harkens back to the theme which we heard about first today, about how the City of London, basically, big finance is controlling everything through their emissaries, their private people trying to gain control over the rest of the world. Again, we have to take back our sovereignty. That is what all of this tells me right now. And also, we have to take a much closer look at PCR testing, which we will do tomorrow in tomorrow's session.
And maybe also look at all the NGOs, because in WHO, there's the World Alliance of Hospitals, the World Alliance of the Alliances of Alliances, and a lot of British people are in charge. And you have to also know that a lot of military are there, because the CDC in the US was formerly military, and I think it still is, by the way. So we have to, I think, disentangle those WONGO, it's the world NGOs, mm-hmm. or the BINGO, the business interested NGOs, mm-hmm. because there are the mechanisms where it's very difficult to find them, and they have a lot of power, more than we think.
The people have to learn that they have to disconnect and look start grassroots democracy, look into their regions and their communities. They know best what's good for them. It is very late already. I know that Dipali is a few hours ahead of us. 3 or 4 hours, right, Dipali?
Yes, 4.5.
Oh, my God. It's been a very long day. And unless there are any further questions, I think we should close this session for tonight. Yes, go ahead, Dexter, please.
Yeah. I just want to talk about, Dr. Sylvia, you were mentioning global health security. And I would like you to perhaps maybe just put it in perspective when it comes to the definition changes from the World Health Organization in 2009.
Well, you mean that you refer to this search pandemic. For the pandemic criteria?
That's correct. Well,
yes. My personal view is that WHO realized they don't need a pandemic definition anymore, because everything that is needed is a fake, a public health emergency of international concern, because they want to manufacture vaccines. And it doesn't matter how the pandemic is defined in non-legal documents. So they actually alleviated the very high threshold, because they realized they can at any time make a public health emergency as long as international spread and as long as they have diagnostics. So they focused no attention to this theme, I think. And that's our problem. And also the lawyers are always looking for this pandemic definition, but it's there are no legal consequences linked to the definition of a pandemic, but there's a huge legal consequence if the director general takes his authority and proclaims a public health emergency of international concern.
Thank you very much.
Does it explain perhaps why they used the models of Sir Ferguson to increase the fear and explain that there is a pandemic, because with the epidemiologists and mathematics that they used, and that is not useful, it's wrongly used to study the spread of the virus. They use this synthetic information from these models, perhaps, because it seems very strange that they use the models of Sir Ferguson that doesn't work at all. And that was these models were duplicated in other countries, like in France, for example. And we took this for granted, and it's not based on experience and medicine at all. It's only mathematics, and we can't use that at all. But I would like to know if it's for this reason that WHO has used these models to increase the fear of the pandemic and to mass manipulate.
I don't know any specifics about it, because actually they had everything they needed to proclaim a public health emergency, and the national governments needed to the population that they would go along, I guess. So they needed it for the population, because there was also the first fake declared in 2009 where the vaccines were manufactured, but nobody was threatened. At least I was not threatened by this fake, because there was no media releases that threatened us. But now they needed the population to stay at home during the lockdowns and to get the vaccine in the end. That's my personal explanation, Astrid, I don't know.
Yes, because from the model of Sir Ferguson, the only solution was vaccines, and no treatment at all, mm-hmm. only vaccines.
But I could just add that there are many definitions of scientific definition. They have changed, not only pandemic. They have changed the definition of health professionals. It's everybody. They have changed data privacy. There is no data privacy anymore. They have not made ethics. For example, in communication in the International Health Regulation Implementation course, and it is a you have to do it. It's to reassure people. Reassure people that we don't know. We are looking for something. You will know what is going on, and step by step you keep people informed. And there it was fair right away. And not only this was a psychological operation for that fear, that constant fear with cases, with images, with deaths that were not deaths, because we know today there is not more mortality in 2020, but also with contradictions, it was said before, and this is in Melanie Klein psychology, you make psychotic people and children when you say, I love you, but I hate you, and you push, or you say, I love you and I hate you at the same time with behavior. So they made a very crazy nonsense of coherence, no control, no sense of control. It's also another concept in psychology. And they made people totally insecure, which diminishes their immunity, by the way. What they also did psychologically, they took away all the religions and all the belief system. And this is something that keeps people up, and they censored religion, they censored death, they forbid the ritual of death, which is one of the most important ritual if you want to have a good grief development, coherence and healing. So there are many things they have done, not just, this manipulation. I don't know Sir Ferguson, but I think I could just add one more. They reversed completely the values. And this is a bit of this Melanie Klein psychotic, I call it the Hansel and Gretel syndrome, because I love you, I'm going to give you this, I'm going to, be ethical, we're going to treat you well with the vaccine, and they're killing them. And this is, they have absolutely abrogated ethics research guidelines that we developed in 2006 to 2009, and I was involved in that. So all the values is also a psychop. They have changed the values and the definitions.
For certain, this is not about health.
No. The World Health Disease Organization.
Professor Ferguson, if I could just clarify, Professor Ferguson, in 2002, he modelled 50,000 deaths would happen in the UK from mad cow disease, and he modelled it completely incorrectly, where we saw the burning of all of our cattle for 150 deaths. So he was very incorrect, and we were very surprised in the UK when we'd found out that Neil Ferguson was responsible for the modelling of this pandemic, because he was so incorrect in the last one. He also hit the headlines a number of times and had to resign from his post in Sage because he was caught breaking lockdown rules. I just wanted to add that about Professor Ferguson.
So the big question is, how come he's still in office?
That's a really good question, and I can't answer that one, I'm afraid, but he shouldn't be. He shouldn't be.
Conflict of interest.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Or nepotism.
He worked very closely with Saudi as well. I forgot. I'll find out the name of. I can't actually read it to pronounce it. But he works very. Imperial College have the largest alumni of Chinese. When President Xi came on his state visit, the only university that he visited was Imperial. Imperial have huge Chinese ties. And they've also taken over a number of our hospitals so that we have now an Imperial NHS Trust. So Imperial, I mean, I could go on for hours about Imperial. And Professor Alice Garst, who's the president of Imperial, who gave a lecture based on 1984, George Orwell, 1984. So there's an awful lot going on at an Imperial, and I could do a lot more about an Imperial. But Professor Ferguson was discredited back in 2002 for mad cow disease. I just wanted to throw that in. Thank you.
It is astonishing indeed how many people who are completely incompetent at what they're doing. One of them being the person who runs the EU Commission. She failed at every single job she's ever held. It's incredible how many completely incompetent people are kept in office, obviously by the people who put them there. Those super rich people who somehow seem to be fueled and kept alive through the city of London and its fifth columns that seem to be everywhere in the world. We will have to take closer looks into all of these occurrences.
Yep. Okay. I would just add one thing is we were talking of Mackenzie and Von der Leyen's son is working for Mackenzie and the son of Fabius in France is working for Mackenzie. And you know the nepotism or it's a term used in popes?
Because nepotism, yes.
Von der Leyen also has a problem when she was Minister of Defense in Germany, I think.
And also when she was the secretary of, I think, families or something like that, she always had problems, but she was always kept in office.
And it was already a problem with the Mackenzie contracts.
Mm-hmm. That is a major, I think Mackenzie is a major institution in all of this, because we have learned from another expert that Bill Gates is using Mackenzie in order to make sure that his advisors become the advisors of, for example, Ursula von der Leyen, all the other major political figures through Mackenzie, through the network of Mackenzie.
Yeah, it's amazing that we have exactly the same messages 2 years ago in the shops and in the airports than now. Really? You know, wash your hands, put the mask. Yeah. I mean, in Europe, at least, for those who don't have those measures. Mm-hmm. But and it's the same voice, and it's like a marketing agency. Mm-hmm.
It is.
So this also should be analyzed if it's the same voice everywhere and, you know, something weird.
We're looking into that as well. But tonight, it's been a very long day, and I know that Deepali needs some sleep. We all do. So unless there's any more questions that urgently need to be answered, I think we should close our session for today.